Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nonprofit. It's Wednesday, November 1st. Unfortunately, Atif is sick today. We were talking about this before the podcast. You know, forecasters really can't take a day off. The world doesn't stop happening. Things don't stop changing. Atif's a little bit soft, but what we're going to do is, you know, I have lots of sound of Atif laughing and saying, yeah, 100%. So we'll just stick that in to make it sound like he's here. Today, we are talking to Bruno Jahn. Bruno is not only a super forecaster who started the Good Judgment Project in its first year, but he is also coming out with a book on forecasting fairly soon, I guess early next year in Germany. So we're excited to talk to him. Bruno also has a master's degree in Islamic Middle Eastern studies and lives in Berlin. Thanks for coming on, Bruno.
Thanks for having me.
So you started the Good Judgment Project when it first started. How did you get involved in it?
Yeah, I got involved in it first because an old friend of mine posted a link on Facebook. His name is Mike Bishop. I don't know. I think some of you may know him.
Yes.
Yeah. He worked for the Good Judgment Project. He lives in Philadelphia now, as far as I know, but I know him from our time at the University of Chicago, where he lived in a large co-op in which I boarded. I didn't live there, but I came over and had meals with them. And I met a lot of great people there, but among them was him, and we kept in touch. And one day he posted a link to this project on Facebook. I think, I don't know where exactly he had heard from it for the first time, possibly through, you know, Tyler Cohen or the Freakonomic blog. Yeah, so he posted a link to it, and I had no idea of the background. I have to admit, I did not know who Phil Tatlock was. I guess I was just intrigued by the basic idea. And then I'm sure you can all relate to this. I increasingly got hooked and ended up spending more and more time. And this was, you know, long before I had any idea about how this project as a whole was doing, what super forecasters were, none of them.
Well, there was no concept of super forecasters originally, right? Like, it was only when certain people began to do well and that was replicable that they even came up with the term. Or am I getting that wrong?
No, I think you're right. That's how I understand it, too. I mean, okay, so the basic idea, I think, was from the get-go that forecasting is a skill that has to do with certain personality traits and other things beyond pure subject matter expertise. And I think it was one of the basic ideas from the start that you would weigh people's opinions partly depending on their past performance, which makes sense if forecasting is a distinct skill where your performance is not simply random, but dependent on skill and, you know, consistently so, at least somehow, somewhat, not 100%, of course. I think that was one of the fundamental ideas from the start. And that, I think, so the super forecasters fit into that. But I think they sort of exceeded expectations on that front. Interesting story. I missed the cut the first year and I got an email. It was pretty depressing, actually. And I almost quit the project because I received an email that told me that I made the cut. And I was very excited about it, even though I didn't really know what it meant. But then I was informed that basically I was the reserve, like of all the people who had worked under the exact same condition as I had, I think they had 12 super forecasters and had chosen one as a reserve in case not everybody participates. And that was me. So it was like the 13th best.
You were an alternate?
Apparently in the first year. And I sort of 2 days later or so, I received an email. It was like, sorry, like you can't be on board because everybody else above you accepted. And it was really frustrating and I almost quit the project. And then in the second year, I was on I was always on teams. And in the second year, I was on a team that was rather inactive on the whole. Yeah, just a lot of people who didn't really work very actively on their forecasts. So at some point, I just decided to, you know, give it all and not trust any teammate to update questions ever and work on every single question on the that year. And then it was funny because in spring 2013, so towards the end of the second year, or the second half of the second year, I should say, I met Mike again. I was in Chicago at the time, and he told me about his, he had made the super forecasting team Christopher Forecaster team in his first year while being in the market. And he told me about the work there and being on this relatively inactive team. I can't deny that I felt quite envious. And so that stimulated my ambition again. And, you know, I worked really hard on all questions and updated practically daily. And yeah, by the end of the second year, I had earned Super Forecaster's honors. And then I spent the third year on a super team with several people who you also probably know, like, for example, Elaine. You have, definitely.
Yeah, we interviewed Elaine.
Yes, and I also saw her in London and Berkeley.
Yes, exactly. So that's where I met her too. Some other, you know, known faces that you all are familiar with. And then in the fourth year, I switched to the supermarket, mostly out of curiosity to see what a prediction market works like. Yeah, which was also an interesting experience, although I have to say that I've always enjoyed working on a team more than the market. And yeah.
So what do you think makes you good at forecasting? What's your secret?
My secret? Oh, geez. I think if I look back on it, I mean, I think one of the big debates that we saw recently, I don't want to go into details here, but it was, if you remember the Google memo story, I don't know if we want to go into this, but there was one aspect of it that I found really interesting, that motivation and interest matters so much, not so much more, but definitely matters so much, not only skill. So my first secret was that I really enjoyed doing this tremendously.
Yeah, it makes a big difference, right?
Huge, because, I mean, some of us have now turned it into a career, but in the beginning, it was not clear at all. None of us predicted that. And
well, there wasn't really a career quite like this. There are people who forecast for a living, but this is different.
Right, but nobody had any idea that this would actually lead to that. At least that's what I would say. That it wasn't about financial rewards, about anything. You just ended up doing it because you enjoyed it. And I think what people enjoy about it, this idea of putting your own knowledge and thinking to the test. That, you know, if you come from an academic background in one of the, I don't quite want to say soft sciences, but, you know, in a discipline where most debates cannot be simply decided empirically, you know, or logically, so by clear proof. I don't know, but I find a lot of the debates that you see in these disciplines ultimately unsatisfying, right? Because they're not, the theories that people have are not really put to the test ultimately. So a lot of depends at the end of the day on, you know, eloquence and your persuasiveness and status and all these things. And, you know, I like I just enjoy to see in forecasting, you know, your ideas are being put to the test. You're sometimes proven to be right. You're sometimes proven to be wrong. I mean, okay, that's maybe a silly comparison, but I once compared it to, you know, when two people debate who's stronger, right? You can, they can, you know, pose and see who has the largest biceps for a while, or they can just, you know, do some arm wrestling about it. And a lot of debate that I see on political issues reminds me of people who endlessly just pose and try to make
their posers
look big. And we're just saying, look, let's get down, let's do a short arm wrestling match, and then we'll know it, and it's much more satisfactory, even if you lose it. And that's because, you know, I once was asked in an interview by someone, are you a person who likes to be right? And I said, yes, I am, but I also, you know, even when I'm wrong, I like it to be clear, you know? So I can, I like to put it to the test and do the little bit of quote unquote arm wrestling and, to have a satisfying outcome. And this is what I really liked about it, right? Put your own knowledge and your theorizing to the test.
There's something that's sometimes confusing for me about forecasting, which is sometimes when I get it right or wrong, I feel like clearly the results they made sense. And whether I got it right or wrong, I could look back through it and say the signs should have been there or were or should have been there, and it's all fine. And then there's sometimes where I really feel like, oh, it really just came down to sort of a matter of luck, because a lot of what we do is not necessarily repeatable. It's something, you know, if you could do basically run something 10 times or 100 times, you may not get the same result each time. And so there are times where even in the market, I felt like I may have gotten a great result and felt like, does this really make me good, or did I get lucky on some of these? Now, I know obviously we've been tested over many, many questions, and so we can say categorically you are a good forecaster, but that doesn't mean that on each question that you or I get right, we definitely deserved it and didn't have some that just sort of broke our way. So I still feel a little bit like sometimes I'm in these discussions or philosophical problems where I can't say this is repeatable every time, which is just a thing of probabilities.
And I think it's also really important to keep this in mind. One of the basic things that we always preach, right? One of the fundamental lessons I think one can draw from the Good Judgment Project is that it's important to keep score and also to learn. But it's funny because when you try to evaluate your forecast, it's by no means clear what the correct lessons are. I remember we did relatively extensive postmortems in season 3 in the super teams. And, basically you take the questions where the team earned the worst Breyer score. We had the worst Breyer scores. And, the implicit assumption is that we did worse on those questions. Now, often this is true, but it all comes back to the problem of being on the wrong side of maybe, right? Occasionally, by definition, when we do probabilistic forecasting, 1 in 10 questions where you correctly estimated the probability to be 10%, you will look spectacularly wrong, but you may not have been. And if we go through these questions, we can have very interesting debates about this. I don't know if we, I think we can talk about these questions, right? I don't think it's classified material at this point. But, okay, so I remember 3 questions from the 3rd year. So that would be mid 2013 to mid 2014, where we earned.
Yeah, that was our first year.
Okay. Yeah. So it was my first year. Yep. Super forecast. So this was the 3 questions where we did worst were the Arafat polonium question, whether,
found
Arafat's remains.
I did terrible on that.
There was the...
I'm still shocked by it.
The infamous Japanese shrine visit. And I think one incident of either an American or Japanese vessel or plane being intercepted by China. And I think these were the 3 worst Breyer scores. And if we go through them, I would say our mistakes were very different. So I think on Arafat, we really mishandled the question itself. I think a lot of people misread the question and they fell victim to what we
call... Let's explain what the question was.
We need to give them background or they won't know. Yeah.
There was a probe they were testing to see... There was a theory, right, that Arafat had been killed with polonium. I guess the same way, what's his name? Litvinenko had been...
Yes.
Yeah.
So they went back and they exhumed Arafat and they tested his body to see whether there are traces of polonium in his body or on his clothing. And we were supposed to predict whether or not the Swiss lab that was doing this would determine that there was polonium there.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, it was actually both labs. So it was a Russian...
2 labs. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yes. Only one of them found it. But the other thing is, so polonium had already been found on his clothes. So the question was, would polonium also be found on his remains? In his bones.
Okay, that's right. Yeah.
So this is interesting, and because most of us were pretty sure they wouldn't find anything, but if you go back and you speak to people, a lot of people I think did intuitively what we call I think attribute substitution, right? They'd answer a different question, and most people answered the question would implicit in their mind, would we find conclusive proof that Arafat was murdered, which we didn't. Which nobody did. There's more than one possible explanation for this. For example, there's a theory that there was a listening device in his compound that was powered by a radioactive battery that could have been the source of that. Now, that does not prove that polonium poisoning was the cause of death for Arafat. It does not prove a lot of other things. It doesn't prove the source of the polonium, none of these things. But given the fact that elevated polonium levels were found in his clothes, clearly the chance that some would be found in his bones was not that far off, right? Whatever you think the source is, whatever you think the explanation is. And I remember...
I guess I don't know if that is clear. I mean, I thought that there might be a different explanation for why the polonium was on his clothing, but I think my mistake was a little bit different. I thought, given the half-life of polonium, that if it had been in his bones when he died, there was no way to detect it. I thought the entire experiment was implausible, even if there had been polonium in his bones. So I just didn't think that they could get this kind of resolution, and I'm still not sure it was good science. But I think I was forecasting whether or not they should be able to find polonium, not whether or not this particular lab might determine that they had found polonium.
But the thing is also, I mean, I'm not saying that we should have known they would find something, but people were ridiculously overconfident on this one, is what I mean. Mm-hmm. People were like 95, 98, 99%, something where most of the forecasters do rarely, you know, being that confident. And I think I was like the most cautious on the team with something in the high 80s, you know? And I'm not saying we should have known there was polonium and gone to 90% guess, but clearly we showed ridiculous overconfidence in light of the fact that polonium had been found on his clothes.
Yeah.
So this is something where we, I think, got the question wrong from the start. The second one is a bit different.
Is the shrine visit?
The shrine visit. So the question was asked in what, late summer, I guess, August, and whether it would happen this year. And we know that these shrine visits...
So the question was, I think it was... Japanese Prime Minister Abe, there was a question whether or not he was going to visit. What was the shrine to?
Yeah, it's Rikosone, and it's basically a shrine to World War II fallen, but this is including to people who are considered to have committed atrocities.
Class A war crimes, yeah.
To the Koreans, to the Chinese. This is a huge, huge affront to visit this place.
Right. It plays to a conservative base, but is outrageous to others.
Right.
To some others.
Right.
So we were trying to predict whether it would happen before a certain date, whether he would visit the shrine.
Yes, precisely. So it's always very controversial. And whether in Japan itself, too. But so the question was, would it happen within 2013? And we worked on the question and we came out with different probabilities. But then what we did was we did classical sort of naive updating, which just says, you know, the more time passes without it happening, the smaller the remaining probability is. Now, for things that happen randomly, you know, that we can model as a Poisson process, so to speak, that just, you know, can happen randomly one day, that makes sense, that procedure. But in this case, I think a lot of us missed the fact that he never planned to do it before, I think, late December, which means that it not happening between August and mid-December didn't mean anything because he never planned to do it in this time. So what we did was we falsely treated this as an event that could have happened at any time randomly, at least for us randomly, you know, in the sense that we don't fully understand the causality and may just as well treat it as a random.
The probability distribution wasn't even over any right. given date. There are some dates, and this is true of a lot of questions, end of the month, the end of the year, holidays.
Put it into an American term, it'd be like, is a president going to visit Arlington? But, you know, are you talking about Memorial Day? The chances are a whole lot higher. Right. So it's not just a random day of the year.
But
so.
We should say what happened was he did visit the shrine. It was just before the end of the year.
Yeah.
And so you're basically saying the people on your team had sort of had the probability decay evenly rather than realize there was a big clump of probability right at the end of the year.
So this was the very different failure mode, so to speak, or a very different type of error. And then the third one, I think we didn't make any mistake at all. We probably correctly guessed the base rate and ended up on the wrong side of maybe. The third question, I should repeat. The third question was whether or not there would be an incident where a Japanese or American plane or vessel is interdicted or forced to land by the Chinese Navy or Air Force within a certain time frame. I don't recall the exact dates. And, you know, we more or less correctly assessed the base rate for that, which isn't very high. It doesn't happen every day. And it did happen, again, relatively shortly before the end of the...
This kind of bad luck coincidence that it happened right at the end of the...
On the wrong side of maybe, basically. but I don't think it would have been correct to give that event a much higher probability. So in this case, so we see we have three questions with similarly bad Breyer score, but the postmortem looks very, very different. And I think you see that all the time. So yes, keeping score in and of itself is not...
The process of trying to understand where you go wrong, and you might be wrong about exactly where you went wrong, but you do it an exercise to try to understand and to try to draw some lessons out of your mistakes.
Yes.
Sometimes I find it very difficult to define what should be the base rate, what should be the window that we look at. And I was just thinking about this yesterday because there was the attack yesterday in New York. And I was thinking that if you asked me on September 12th, when I wasn't really forecasting anything, but if you said, what would be the probability that there will be a fatality in New York related to a Islamic terrorist event, when will the next one occur? I would have said, you know, 99% chance that it would be before 2017. But now if I was asked the same question again, if I was asked the question today, when is the next one going to occur? Well, do I look at the base rate and say, oh, they happen once every 16 years, because that's actually our base rate right now? Or do I look at the last 2 months and say they happen all the time? You know, like how far back should I go? Because obviously there are historical things that have changed between now and then. And, you know, it becomes... With things that have a very that don't have a big sampling, it can become very difficult to determine base rates.
Absolutely.
Well, I think this is why it got called good judgment, is that there is an element of judgment in this.
Yeah.
There is no, we don't know how to articulate any kind of algorithmic hard and fast rules about what's the relevant period of time you want to look at the base rate for or anything like that. It's an art that you have to cultivate with practice.
The base rate that there will be a different president in 9 years, I'm pretty confident on that one. I might not go to 100, but I'd probably go really high.
Well, you have a reason for thinking that. You have a theory that guides your judgment.
Absolutely. But yeah, so wait, how did we get here again? Sorry, we talked about the whole process of going back and learning from it. And
yeah.
So I
was asking what your secret was.
Yeah. So exactly. My secret, I think, is mostly being fascinated by this and by this process of trying to figure out whether you're right or not, and by doing hypothesis testing and by especially applying this to politics. I mean, because politics is so strongly dominated by, you know, normative thinking. And this is, you know, purely the opposite. It's not about what should be. You know, you have to get rid of all ideas of what you want to happen and just focus on what you think will happen. And that just puts to test so much, right? It's a great bullshit filter, I think.
Well, we should ask you some more about it. Before we get on to sort of, because you've talked about fake news and BS, so we want to ask you about that. But I did have another question, which is for the podcast, you have a degree in Islamic or Middle Eastern studies, and you said, well, it wasn't that relevant to your forecasting. So that's an interesting question to me. Do you think that your expertise, the fact that you studied the Middle East in some way, gives you any edge in questions that relate to the Middle East? Because we do a lot of that. Or does it really not? Is it really not helpful?
If you look at the Breyer score, you will, at least for me, I have done worse on regions and topics that I'm supposed to know more about, clearly. And that's okay, now you can say maybe, you know, the Middle East generally was a more volatile region. Probably most people's Breyer scores were worse.
Did you relatively worse compared to other forecasters, or just those were hard questions?
I don't know with certainty. I can't answer that with certainty. I can clearly, I would say that generally I did not do very well.
Yeah, but that's interesting because I did better on the Middle East than most people, but I did worse on Russia, where I felt like I had some background. So I fit the same pattern as you of not doing well on things I should do well on.
And a lot of people say that. I don't know if being too close to subjects is sometimes, I mean, I did terrible on the US election. Of course, I think that was a little bit of a black swan in some ways, but maybe that's because I was too invested in it or knew too much and had too many prior theories that I couldn't shake off.
Right. It's about overconfidence, of course, and maybe just that you even take, I mean, in the way we work, we can sort of choose which questions we even answer, and maybe we actually overestimate our ability to forecast even difficult questions in these fields. I don't know. But clearly, I think, and I mean, this goes back all the way to Tetlock's original research long before Good Judgment Project. You can see that in highly complex fields, like more knowledge, hits the point of diminishing returns very quickly, so to speak. More knowledge very quickly doesn't help anymore. Subjectivities. It's interesting, like, I think on the super team, I got an idea of what better role of experts can be, because we really had a mode of working where often people with more knowledge would give sort of a brief outline of the facts at stake, but then would not be considered authorities on the actual forecasting question. So that there's a lot of stuff in the Eurozone and, you know, common banking resolution mechanism. And we had people with an economics background on the team and would give us concise summaries of what's really at stake here. And this is something you can only do with a certain level of subject matter expertise. But they would not be by themselves, the expertise does not in and of itself give them authority on the forecasting question itself. But I really saw for me, I don't want to sound dramatic, but a positive vision of what expertise can and cannot do, and what a better role of expert could be, including in the media, you know, with punditry.
They're good at getting information to analysts, basically, to forecasters. I think I get detail that I wouldn't be able to have otherwise. But I'm also curious about something, which is you have background, and a lot of super forecasters have this. You have background of knowing more than one culture. Obviously, growing up in West Berlin and then, you know, United Berlin, but also having lived in America some, having studied the Middle East, even if you didn't do very well on Middle Eastern questions, I think you've delved into more than one culture in a more in-depth way than, say, an average person would. And I'm curious, you know, so even if you're, you know, I don't know, forecasting on something in South America, which may not be your area of expertise, at least you may have an ability to be able to view things beyond your own cultural norms.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think this is also something that Tetlock, I think, found, and that in the original study, that regional expertise is one of the things that really don't help much, partly because you're too invested. Can I tell you an anecdote that hits this point home to me? So a friend of mine was living in Egypt at the time, 2011, you know. So she talks to a guy who's been living in Egypt for several years, an American expat, but who works in some political organization, NGO, and very knowledgeable about politics and everything. And, you know, the protests in Barak just start to really become much, much bigger. And she asks him, you know, like, where is this going? You know, do you see this going anywhere? And basically he says, are you kidding me? Nothing ever changes. Mubarak will die in office and he'll keep going as a hologram for another 10 years after that. You know, nothing ever changes in this country, basically. Maybe a kind of professional cynicism here. And this very same day, she Skypes with a friend in America who says, I've seen the pictures on CNN of these huge protests on Tahrir Square. Like, it looks like everything has changed. Person who probably could not have found Egypt on the map the day before or even then, and obviously gets it better than the supposed expert, free of any previous assumptions of any priors. She just turns on CNN. And I think if you look at some of the stories, like what happens in the State Department in certain moments of crisis, say during the Iranian Revolution, you have a similar picture, you know, the Sovietologists in the State Department, in the intelligence community in 1989-90-91, same story. The people who have been dealing with countries and regions and subjects for a long, long time are often very slow to realize things are about to change.
Right, just the fact that it was on CNN and an American who'd never been to Tahrir Square knew what was going on, that's a pretty strong signal that something unusual is happening.
Exactly. That, like, this is my very first year. My spectacular failure was a question about Germany. where I sort of, you know, within the team, this is, I'm still relatively inexperienced. So I still think this thought at the time that my knowledge really matters here. And I say, you know, I'm the German here. I read 10 German papers online every day. I'm the authority on this question of whether or not the German president Wolf was, you know, there was a scandal coming up about some corruption from his earlier political life and whether or not he would have to resign. And, I thought he would not resign. I thought he would sit this one out. And I claim authority in team discussions, right? And I'm spectacularly wrong. I think a lot of the people who knew far, far less about Germany had the same kind of filter. You know, the international pages of the New York Times bring a story about it. That probably it matters, right? And then there's another story the same week. You know, wow, this really matters. A filter that I didn't even have anymore at the time. So
let's ask you about your book. So you have a book coming out. It's coming out in April. You're about to finish it up, I guess. Can you tell us sort of, well, first of all, what the title is, but sort of what the central message is? How would you pitch this? How would you describe it to people who know nothing about it?
Okay, so it's a pop sci book, which means it...
But what's it called? Start there.
So the working title, it's still not 100% sure, is something like, how can I translate this? Certain forecasts in uncertain times, you know?
What's the German?
Sichere Prognosen in unsicheren Zeiten. How would you translate this even? Yeah, certain forecasts in uncertain times or something?
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, the idea is that...
But certain, do you mean it? Certain is a sense of like confident or... Because you're not saying you absolutely... You're not talking about forecasts where you're... About prophecy.
Right. So the debate about the title sort of reflects a fundamental theme of my work on the book, which is what the target audience is here. I think this title is supposed to be a reputable, serious. We were contemplating a somewhat more sensationalist or actually silly title. I was contemplating a sillier title.
What was the silly title you had in mind?
Several ones. The one was The One-Eyed Seer, which I like because... So my basic idea is say, you know, we can't become clairvoyant. We can become a little less wrong. And the idea of the one-eyed seer. So on the one hand, you know, you have the version of the one-eyed man who's king.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king or something like that.
The other is also that the seer in mythology sometimes has to be blind in order to be clairvoyant.
Right. They only have the other sight. They don't have the regular sight.
Exactly. So that the one-eyed person would, you know, not be fully clairvoyant, but like a little better than a person with two eyes. So the idea is here that, you know, we can become gradually better at forecasting without being clairvoyant.
You're saying we're Cyclops.
Exactly. Just a little less strong physically, I'm afraid, unfortunately.
How dare you?
The other title, I was even, you know, contemplating even sillier ones, like, I don't know, Look Into My Future, Baby, basically is the would say, you know, instead of looking my, like that, you know.
Just as a German lesson, how do you say Look Into My Future, Baby in German?
Schau mir in die Zukunft, Kleines.
Great. I'll have to use that.
Schau mir in die Zukunft, yeah. So look, instead of look into eyes, you know, look into my future. Yeah. We were contemplating this, and so I guess the title, in a sense, already reflects the fact that the book is placed in a sort of targeted, tailored for a different market segment.
What market segment is it tailored for?
At least, am I serious?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically, you know, we're not going for the broadest possible mass appeal here. This is maybe a way of putting it. Yeah, I don't really know.
Is this going to be pitched to business people, as so many of these forecasting books are?
I think that is hardly what the publisher has in mind, to be honest. I think it is sort of the, you know, the frequent flyer book, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The kind of segment that they basically assume if you don't have a certain affinity towards numbers and these things, you're unlikely to read it and buy it. I think that's part of the idea here, which may very well turn out to be realistic. But, you know, maybe not.
This is maybe a bad question, but how would your book differ from the style or the way that the Super Forecaster book that Tetlock and Gardner wrote? I mean, other than obviously it's in a different language. I assume you're taking a different approach than theirs.
Okay, so there's obviously a certain degree of overlap between the two books, just on a content.
Yeah.
But it is also supposed to be a subjective account of what it means to be a forecaster. I mean, I think I can say that without giving anything away.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting with almost stream of consciousness-like passage where I sit in front of a computer late at night and I know I should go to bed, but I can't stop working on this question, and I'm doing online research, and I find English language Arab websites that I have no idea how reputable they are or where they stand ideologically, who report certain incidents in Yemen about amphibious troops landing in Aden, and whether or not this event would trigger a question on our prediction market about Saudi intervention in Yemen. Now I start buying shares and actually going wrong on that question.
I remember the question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you also lost thousands of fictional dollars.
No, I did. Inkles or whatever they were called. Yeah. No, I didn't in that one.
I did. So again, the Middle East, I did not shine on those questions. But anyway, so it's supposed to be a very personal account of what this means. Of course, it also covers other things. I have a lot of references to mythology and how the ancients, they dealt with these questions. I talk about the role of experts in societies, which is often not that different in the present from what it was in antiquity, where you had augurs or priests.
Do you actually cut open the stomachs of animals to read their entrails in your forecasts?
Sort of. But the point is that
sort of. You're supposed to say no. No, I never do that. That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm saying that our methods may not be that much more rigorous on.
That's great. It's probably yes. True.
And no, my actual point is that social role of forecasters are very similar. So I have another scene where I contrast, again, I think I can say this without giving anything away. This scene where I contrast two scenes, the augurs approving of a military expeditions in Rome and the leading German economists presenting their consensus forecast for another year. But I used 2 years where both ended up being really, really wrong. And I think you still see parallels, that you have a ritualized process in which experts present forecasts which have the function to legitimize certain acts of the government. And they may end up being wrong, but even if they do, they distribute responsibility in some way. That's another theme of the book, right? So the role of experts. And I talk about the research of Tetlock on how good experts on these matters are. And my basic hypothesis is that, again, that goes back to the same question about, how useful is expert knowledge on these questions. We have this expression, a little knowledge is dangerous. And if our measure for what is a little knowledge is the human mind, then this is dangerous because depending on the subject, a human expert who is very smart and has spent decades studying this may still be in little knowledge territory.
Yeah.
So at this point, other things like epistemic reflection, epistemic humility, if you will, come into play rather than expert knowledge. And yeah, I talk about this a little. I talk about, of course, the basic biases in Kahneman, and I talk about which biases I think, because the bias thing, it has sort of, I think it has gone too far. We have seen an inflation of possible biases. I think the literature now knows 300 or 400 different biases, many of which may not really be all that robust, basically. But I think you can really boil it down to a handful that matter in the forecasting process. And that's confirmation bias. It is, well, all kinds of wishful thinking. It is all those that make you lose track of proportions. So that includes scope insensitivity or base rate neglect or anchoring, really. And then, well, of course, the conjunction fallacy plays into it, our tendency to not realize just how unlikely combinations of events become. You know, when you do scenario exercises, people start hopelessly overrating the likelihood of highly specific scenarios. And then really the mother of all biases, in my opinion, the hindsight bias, which keeps us from learning. Then I give some information about, you know, basics of probability. And again, you know, I'm not a mathematician. I don't know that much about it, but I think you can really, with a few basic, really enhance the forecasting process. If you have a certain idea of how to, for example, you know, we talked about this just a few minutes ago. Normally, if an event is randomly distributed over time, you can just, you know, as more time passes, the event becomes ever less likely. But that may not always be true, of course, as we've seen in the example with the shrine. But in general, this is really one of these basic little insights from probability.
We get into an interesting issue that we often have increasingly well-written forecast questions. And so sometimes the end date is not just some random point in time. And so sometimes that's very obvious, like, okay, there's an election and we know that there should be a result at a certain point. But there are other times where if something's going to end on October 30th is when we have to have the decision by, they may have made that for a very specific reason or even a cutoff point in terms of where some price is going to be or something. And so we do have to do quite a bit of digging sometimes to find out what was the, you know, is there anything like that that comes up? Is there some frequency that we're skipping?
Exactly. But again, this is an example where some basics of the probabilities really help you. Then I talk a little bit, of course, about Bayesian updating. And again, you know, how about common sense Bayesianism? Because most of the time, most of us can easily recite the theorem of Bayes, but really, most...
I'm doing the math all the time.
Yes, the thing is, it's interesting that most of the time we don't really do it with, you know, hard numbers, but there's this common sense...
Because we don't have hard numbers.
Exactly. But you use common sense Bayesianism, you know, what is the expression? A Bayesian is someone who expects a horse and sees something that looks like a donkey, so he concludes that it's probably a mule, right? The idea here, you know, you don't throw out everything, you don't go all the way all of a sudden, but you still change your opinion in light of new facts. And of course, and quite honestly, quite frequently, saying Bayes is just a fancy way of saying I'm updating beliefs, right? And changing my opinion on something, even when you don't do it in any formal way whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I talk about, you know, media and fake news and echo chambers, and that forecasting, I think, can show us a way out of these problems.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk first about your introductory scenario, because I think in the fake news era, this is pretty important. But a lot of what we do in this kind of open source work we do is evaluate sources. Like I've found that that's one of the biggest things. I have some information. How do I figure out if it's good information or not? So how do you think you do that? If you have an English language source about Yemen and you've never seen it before, how do you decide if the information is any good?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think a lot of it is relatively intuitive. So you try to, in this example, I would say, you know, you try to look at least a couple of articles and see, do they have a very, very strong ideological tendency? Do they clearly seem to take a side in a conflict?
I also try to track down sometimes the ownership of the, whether magazine or whatever the format is. I try to find out who owns it, what their background is. And sometimes you can find out the ideology from looking at the provenance of the...
Sometimes you can, but...
of the institution.
This background info is not available and you really just have the publication itself. You can try to look for a general ideological tendency, but really, again, I think valuing the credibility of a single source is usually not the way to go. I mean, in this case, you see, it led me to make a big mistake, in fact, trusting that one source. But in general, if we talk about fake news and echo chambers as a societal problem, I think super forecasting or forecasting in general can maybe show us a way out in the sense that, you know, if making the most accurate forecasts is your goal, you really can't afford to be tribal and partisan. It is simply, it will sooner or later ruin your forecasting ability and your record, because you have ideological blind on. And we, without giving any, without naming any particular culprits here, it really, if you try to make accurate forecasts, I think that's an excellent way. People almost automatically will start looking at a broader variety of news sources, and including some that they find ideologically reprehensible. But you know, look at it. I mean, it's not even that I think these other news outlets will provide you better with better information, but it's about getting a different perspective on things. Like, you know, I don't think that Russia Today is a very good source of information, but I would say that probably reading it at least occasionally gave you a better idea about what the Russian perspective on certain international conflicts was, you know. And I'm not saying you would have predicted Russia's actions in Syria with 100% accuracy, but you probably were a little less surprised by that. You just get an idea of how, and really, I mean, today this is very easy to do with the information that we have available through the internet. I mean, you can, basically every country in the world now has English language news sources. Not all of them high quality, not all of them objective, not all of them, you know, okay, objectivity is a big word in this context anyways, but, you know, some of them with a clear ideological bent, but nonetheless, it's information out there. And I think that's one of the big lessons for me from the entire project, that all kinds of information can matter. And it's no coincidence that I think many super forecasters are generally better when it comes to questions that they're not heavily invested in. You know, the original 4 years, I think there were no questions about domestic U.S. policy at all, right? And still 80% or so of the participants, I think, were from the U.S. So most of these questions, most people did not have a strong ideological preference, really, for either outcome. I mean, of course, some, you may hope for peace over war or for no disaster over disaster, but still. I think I don't have the exact numbers ready, but I don't. The American super forecasters did that well on Trump, right? They still did better than other media outlets. This is more difficult when you're heavily ideologically invested, obviously. Yeah, and we see the media polarization. I mean, you see these graphs where you see that there's almost no overlap anymore between the readership or viewership of certain outlets, right? And that's a problem.
Yeah, in the United States right now, you have one population that is getting a story that Hillary Clinton colluded with the Russians to get kickbacks about uranium sales as uranium management. And another part of the country has never heard of this story and is just hearing about the Mueller investigation. And it's incredible to me how divergent these have become in the United States.
But I'm also surprised in the last short period of time how it's not just newspapers I would have thought had a very strong ideological bent, but like even the Wall Street Journal, which I would have considered, you know, conservative, but I thought of it still as, you know, I'm going to clearly give my bias here, but clearly what I considered a relatively objective paper, and they're calling for the dismissal of Mueller. And I'm like, wow, this...
There's always been a big difference between the Wall Street Journal's opinion page and the Wall Street Journal's reporting.
Yes, yes. But their opinion to me is getting, you know, further out of what I consider mainstream.
Yeah.
Maybe that is mainstream. I don't know. But yeah, I'm having a hard time finding anything that's much in the middle. Now, I would say that there are certainly papers that I still think that they're reporting relatively objectively in the news section, not in the editorial. But
yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's a struggle.
I don't think that really objectivity of single outlets is the goal here or the realistic expectation. I really think it's about trying to incorporate a variety of sources into your diet. And also very interesting, I mean, to me is always this idea of which news should you follow at all? I speak about that a little bit in the book. A lot of people have said, you know, have in fact mocked super forecasters as unemployed news junkies. I don't know who exactly said that, but there was...
It's not wrong, is it?
But this is the thing. I'm far less of a news junkie today than I was at some point in my life because I filter out very differently.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I got started to follow...
Oh, we're good news junkies. We're not just indiscriminate news junkies.
Right, but it's, so for example, I'll give you an example. So when I started out, you know, following politics and reading news, being a kind of geeky 14-year-old, right? I probably at 16, I could have named all heads of government of the European Union, all members of the German cabinet, and all heads of the German states, single states, the 16 German states, the Länder. Today, I probably could not name half of any of these groups. So that's just a way of an indicator of a different approach to the news, right?
Right.
Trying to not follow the day-to-day small stuff that happens, but rather broader developments. And, you know, on some questions, then when you're dealing with a particular question, you may sometimes have to deal with the daily stuff, the really, really recent stuff. But in general, I'm trying to increasingly filter that stuff out, and with some success. And writing about this has really made me think about it differently. Like, what am I actually doing here? How do I consume news? How do I just, which article, how do I decide which articles to click on, right? And I recommend this actually as an exercise to the reader to go to a major news site. And for me, that would be Spiegel Online, or the New York Times site, or CNN website, whatever, and scroll down the front page and, you know, decide which stories you click on, and then test where do you, when do you find that this really gave you additional information beyond the headline that you needed to know about. And I think I'm following a very different news diet these days, and I hope this is a good approach. Maybe the forecasting performance is a strong argument to follow my example here. I don't know. But in general, I'm trying to get the reader to reflect on their own habits in this regard, and to, yeah, look a little beyond their own respective echo chamber, even though that is sometimes hard to do.
I find it's really interesting sometimes when you start to investigate things. Let's say you find a source that says there's amphibious landings going on in Yemen, and you want to evaluate it. You start looking for other sources, and then sometimes you may find no other source. And then you have to wonder, why is this the only source that's reporting it? And that's an interesting question itself. Do they know more, or is it some kind of a rumor? Is it some kind of a leak that someone's trying to say something? Like, it helps a lot to be more confident when you get confirmation from other different perspectives. But often one of the things you find that's fascinating to me is you find a bunch of articles saying the same thing, but you see the same language in them, or they refer all back to one another. And then you realize there's still just one source for it. Or you may find that other people are saying it's not happening. And then you have to evaluate between them. So you learn a lot by looking and comparing the different news sources about really where the information is coming from and how good it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for example, it's incredibly interesting to do this in the case of really ongoing events on Twitter, when you have all kinds of unconfirmed things popping up. And to just, I don't know, some people have actually worked in journalism. I have not. But it's very interesting to see how this process unfolds, and how certain things are being reported and get confirmed or not. It really, you know, with this real-time structure, provides a lot of insight into that. Twitter is another example that I talk about. You know, some people say that blame social media for the polarization. And I guess that's true, the way a lot of people handle it. But at the same time, it is easier than ever before to get ridiculous variety of perspective on, especially on Twitter. On Facebook, maybe not so much, but on Twitter, it's almost, I mean, it's, yeah, it is ridiculously easy. I can only repeat that, to huge variety. And if you're using it, maybe subconsciously, to only have your priors confirmed, then you're doing something wrong.
I'm guilty of not using Twitter, but one thing that I'm curious, and I probably should be, but one thing I'm curious about with Twitter, or any way of sourcing information, is, like, currently there has been a tremendous amount of coverage of North Korea, although it's still a relatively opaque place. But obviously, with the deaths of four people in Niger, four Americans, It seemed that a lot of people were caught off guard, were not really understanding how heavily involved the U.S. was in, I believe it's, I don't remember if it's 17 or 20 countries in Africa that we, you know, admit to having, you know, active.
Well, yeah, it's not reported in the U.S.
Yeah. And I don't know how easy it is to pick that information up, how much of that with Twitter, how you have to basically filter that, you know, to get that information and, you know, basically to be aware. I mean, I was certainly aware of large regions of Africa that have insurgent groups, you know, whether it's IS or Al-Qaeda or Shabab, and, you know, they change names and affiliations. But basically, I knew that whole, I knew a very, very large swath of Africa, basically North Central Africa, that has major problems. But I don't know details, you know, country by country, except in a few areas there. And, you know, that's, I think that's sort of like a black, it's a bad word to use, I say black hole for us. It's an area where we don't really have a lot of, yeah, we have no coverage in the U.S. until something happens.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I don't think that Twitter really is a great source of information into things, into facts that are otherwise unreported. Because, you know, on Twitter, you don't have a lot of facts.
You do get good live reporting, I think, from the site of a disaster or a protest.
Right, but you can also get an idea, not reliable information about what exactly the U.S. is doing in Niger, for example. What you do get is different perspectives on certain things. So you could, how can I put this? Like, you can get an idea of what parts of the world think about certain conflicts and certain topics, which I find incredibly valuable, and you can get perspectives on a variety of questions. Not all of which are, technically speaking, forecasting. Yeah, that's actually another thing I talk about in my book, that I'm strongly in favor of, this is almost philosophical, you could say, very much in favor of expanding the idea of what forecasting is, because structurally we see a lot of similarities to things that are not strictly speaking forecasting, such as medical diagnoses or judicial investigations, right, where things have already happened, but you're trying to figure out what exactly happened very often, or it's really scientific hypothesis testing.
Still evaluating evidence in some way and using judgment about what's reliable.
Right, and you talk, you know, when you talk about predictive power of a theory, for example, that may not be strictly, you know, in the sense of predicting an event, but predicting, for example, the result of a study or of a medical diagnosis.
Or treatment.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So you have these debates about really, you know, interesting sociological questions, for example, some of which are highly controversial. I really think that Twitter still is an amazing place for these kinds of debates and to get a broad variety of viewpoints. If you use it to only have your price confirmed, I think you're doing something wrong. But at the same time, I also understand that a lot of people feel overwhelmed by the speed at which Twitter operates. And if you feel already sort of news exhaustion or burnout, then getting on Twitter, if you weren't there already, is maybe not such a great idea, to be honest. But again, like, I want to say that we can, it really depends how you use the possibilities of the internet and certain forms of media. Good Judgment Project would never have been possible before the current age of...
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, because it really strikes me, the internet spreads disinformation, but it also spreads information. And I don't think we could really do this kind of open source forecasting the same way. I know that Expert Political Judgment was written back in the, you know, as experiments for the 80s and I think early 90s.
Expert Political Judgment went, I think, from 84 to 2003.
Oh, it went that long, right?
Yes.
But you could only do a limited amount of stuff. I couldn't find out what was going on in Azerbaijan or, you know, if I wanted the news, I'd have to actually go to the library and see what papers they subscribe to. You know, I couldn't just go online at 3 a.m. and read anything in the world, read Al Monitor or whatever it is.
Absolutely. And that's, I think it's kind of sad that these days, you know, we only talk about the downsides of all this. It's not for nothing that we do that. We do see the downsides, but it's sad in the sense that so many people use I don't want to quite say they use it to confirm their price, because I think a lot of people don't do that consciously. But it takes a little bit of actively seeking out opposing viewpoints. And really, I mean, we saw it with the Trump election, right? We saw that substantial amount of people simply did not take notice of what was going on in large parts of the country, right? By large parts of the country, I don't necessarily mean geographically, but, you know, large parts of society. The echo chamber, the filter bubble, whatever you call it, is a real issue. And people have completely distorted views of what other people and the rest of society really thinks about certain questions. Interestingly, in both directions. So people can both completely overestimate how many people agree with them and how many people are the enemy, right? It's not universal. People do not, I mean, oftentimes people overestimate how much support their side has, but not necessarily. You know, they can also feel marginalized when really they aren't with their opinions.
You talk in the book, after year three of the Good Judgment Project, we were invited to a Super Forecaster conference in Berkeley. A lot of us met there. I think I probably met you in passing. I don't remember. We didn't talk necessarily. But you describe in the book, I guess, what it was like meeting the other supers in Berkeley. So I'm curious, what were your impressions? What are we like as a group? Is there a type?
Yeah. You usually get back to this beautiful quote by Nick Hare that has been, I know, it's been used a few times.
I don't know what it is. I'm excited.
Oh, really? You don't? Okay. So he was interviewed and he said, I think he said, it's a little like at the end of E.T. when the other aliens come and he's no longer an alien, mm-hmm. in a sense. And a lot of people felt
I did hear that.
A unique rapport with other super forecasters. And I'm not.
I did.
That there is this idea of, wow, all of a sudden, you know, everybody on this table shares these interests, these perspectives. And it, I think, is part of the reason, you know, that most super forecasters are not your classic policy wonk, is that it's an opportunity for people who have these interests to meet like-minded people. This may not have been the original motivation to join, but it really, I'm sure it contributed to, you know, people continuing to spend time with the project. Yeah, is that many of them do not have a lot of people in their daily life that share these interests to the same extent, at least. And it doesn't even have to be a particular, again, subject matter interest, but really the interest in doing this and testing your own hypotheses this way, right? And all I can say is that these almost 72 hours were very, very intense experience that I've hardly ever felt before in the same way, that, you know, you all of a sudden meet all these people who are on, yeah, it's a cliched phrase to say they're on the same wavelength as yourself, but I think it is, it does describe this in a way, you know, a degree of openness, of discussing these things with a certain curiosity, and the knowledge really is not the main factor. Yes, it's there, so you also encounter a lot of impressive levels of knowledge, and oftentimes, you know, on subjects that you so far have always thought you were the only person interested in. And then there's other people on the table who can also, you know, provide really interesting input on it. But really, it's more of, I think, it's more of a question of how you think than what you know, really. And that speaks to the experience. And really also see the tremendous, the differences in backgrounds, right? I mean, okay, let's be honest, like demographically, the crowd is not that diverse, but there's a big diversity in professional experience. There's not the typical super forecaster biography. As you said, there are certain parallels. A lot of them have lived in more than one country. A lot of them have switched careers. A lot of them have more than one field of expertise, you may say, but really there's not your typical super forecaster in terms of professional background. So it was interesting to just see how much you have in common with these people.
I had the exact same experience when I go this, I don't want to be too dramatic about this, but I feel like I go through life having conversations with people about politics or even just about, you know, basic logical things and feeling kind of like a lot of people are very unreasonable. They have sort of magical thinking ideas, sort of vaguely paranoid, not, you know, they don't think about things very clearly to me. That's what I feel like. That sounds kind of rude, but that's often what I feel like. And meeting other super forecasters, I thought, well, they're all reasonable about things. They all work through things in the same way I do. And it was nice. to feel like I was, you know, a group of people which I related to that way.
Also, if we don't always have the same opinions or come to the same conclusions, but I usually feel like the process that the other person is going through or the group is going through is still somehow sustainable, supportable. It's, they have reason behind what they're thinking. And I do have people outside of Sure. forecasters who are that way, but it's, Yeah. it's a, let's say, a much smaller number. It's a much smaller number. And so to be in a group where, you know, let's say more or less literally everyone is that way. And yet there's also, I think maybe it's because all of us have had the experience of being tested across many, many questions. And obviously we have all failed horribly or been on the wrong side of maybe horribly on at least some of them. That there is, I think we all have some, you know, as much as we may be somewhat arrogant, I think we all have enough humility to say we've been wrong many times. So that makes it, you know, where we're all curious to hear from each other, not just to be like, okay, I've got the answers and I'm going to be here to stand up and, you know, tell everybody what's right. The way we work, basically, ad hominem attacks are really completely forbidden. And so, I mean, occasionally something creeps up, but it's very, very rare. And so it is an environment in which I think, you know, we feel free to express ourselves and not, you know, it's a comfortable environment for us.
I think that the humility is part of it. And I think we learn humility because our forecasts fail. And I also think that a lot of super forecasters, you know, have a fairly high self-regard. They're proud of themselves in some way. But I think that the people who tend to be good at forecasters are already people who don't have too much confidence in their opinion, who understand that, you know, they might be wrong about stuff. And that's what makes them, I think it's a big part of what makes them good to begin with, is that even though they may think they're the best, they also sort of realize that they could still be wrong about a lot of things and are willing to reevaluate their opinions.
Absolutely. And I think that is very simple. You know, when you said that some people are unreasonable, I'm sure super forecasters are also highly unreasononable about many things.
Sure.
But they are far more open to discussing that fact and to checking it, you know. And
reflective in some way.
And again, it's really difficult to describe this in a sense, I think. And maybe I hope we did a good job to people who haven't made this experience. But yeah, to feel this kind of connection to people, and again, this is, so many people describe it, that this is something that they've previously rarely encountered in their lives, and certainly never, you know, maybe they've encountered other individuals with whom they clicked in this way, but certainly never an entire table of people, and not just one table, several tables of them. Yeah, it was an intense experience still, and I love it every time, you know, I meet a group of super forecasters. It's still, it's always a great pleasure to me. Yeah.
Me too. We should probably wrap up, but I have another question, which is, what's the holdup? Why are we going to get a Jamaica coalition in Germany?
Right now, well, I should say that I was on television less than 2 months ago saying we won't.
Do you stick by that, or have you updated your beliefs?
Well, at this point, I mean, saying that I have. We are going to see one. Although I maintain that I think it's a terrible idea for most parties involved, namely the FDP and the Greens.
Can you explain actually what a Jamaica coalition is? I didn't give any background to that question.
So the German federal election has produced an unprecedented situation in that we now have 6 parties in parliament. The right-wing AfD for the first time entered parliament, the FDP entered it, and that made building a coalition much more difficult. Both traditional major parties, CDU and SPD, lost a significant amount of votes.
SPD doesn't want to be in a grand coalition anymore either. I mean, that's a big part of the problem.
That is the big part of the problem, exactly. But honestly, so I think their hope to regain strength in the opposition is probably futile. Because I think the weakness of the SPD is part of a much larger picture of a weakness of center-left parties in almost all of Europe. The traditional center-left, the SPD, the Labour Party, the Socialists in France, have in many countries collapsed. I mean, Labour did okay, but honestly, in the UK, the Tories were basically in self-destruct mode. So I think we need to take a Labour's respectable result here with a grain of salt, because if they couldn't win against Tories in that state, I don't think they're as strong as people make them out to be. Basically, I think with the strength of the SPD, the weakness of the SPD is part of a larger picture of collapse of the traditional center-left throughout Europe. I don't think that going into the opposition will, in and of itself, provide much of a recovery for the SPD. But okay, they have made the decision, and which I didn't predict, honestly. And now that leaves us with the CDU-FDP-Green coalition as a possibility.
This is called the Jamaica Coalition because of the colors of the Jamaican flag and the colors of the parties.
Yes, black, yellow, and green. And it's clearly not a love marriage for obvious reasons. I mean, the FDP and the Greens are obviously the most obvious contrast, which really, I mean...
What are the sticking points?
That's the thing. There's more than one specific sticking point. FDP and Greens, for all their animosity, are really fundamentally very close to each other in the demographics that they compete for. The FDP has profited dramatically from being out of parliament, I think, in the past 4 years, and thus being a credible opposition. They have promised a course, free market economics. This is the thing, call it neoliberal, if you will. I don't like that term, but, lower taxes, deregulation.
Reaganomics.
Reaganomics is too specific because it also, Reaganomics, I think, also usually, a central part of Reaganomics was, in fact, large public deficits, which the FDP, at least on paper, of course, I mean, if you look back at their record in government in the past decade, different picture emerges. The main problem to me is that both the Greens and the FDP, I think both hope that the other side will be uncompromising on some issues so that they can stand up and leave the room and, appear principled, because both of them are dealing with a suspicion or with the, justified suspicion, they totally sell out all their principles. And especially with the Greens, I mean, the Greens are in an identity crisis in that they, usually where they have been in government, they are making extremely centrist policy, but they still have a base that dreams of a far more leftist course on certain issues. So parts of the Green base basically want to have an even more welcoming refugee policy. But if you look at what the Greens do once they are in government, especially in the southwestern state of Baden-Württemberg, it doesn't look that way at all to me. But really, I mean, how can I put this? I still think that this is a terrible idea for the parties involved. And again, like, I think part of being honest in your assessment of these things is you should, after you were wrong spectacularly, you should not 5 minutes later explain exactly how things are going to be now. And honestly, I don't really know where we're going from here. I think that on a policy level, really not much will change in Germany. But the fundamental policy course will remain very centrist and will remain, what we've seen from Merkel in the past 12 years mostly. Yeah, I do not claim to really understand the dynamics here at play.
Why do you think the center is collapsing in Europe? I mean, you just had Austrian elections and you had the dominant central parties just disappeared practically. And then you have sort of more extreme parties on the right and the left. And we've seen that a lot of places, even in the US. Why is it happening? Do you have an opinion about that?
I would not quite say that all the center parties are collapsing. It's especially the center left parties that are collapsing.
Yeah.
In general, Europe has not been doing great economically in the past couple of years, large parts of Europe, let's say. So the anti-incumbent mood is understandable, I would say, or at least is what you would expect. It's interesting that it in many countries now seems stronger than when the crisis was more acute.
Yeah,
Trump was not elected a populist figure that is radically anti-establishment on at least certain counts was not elected right after the crisis struck. He was elected after 7 years of ongoing economic recovery, which of course not reached everybody. And, you know, a lot of regions and individuals and demographic groups are...
But by a lot of measures, the U.S. is doing fairly well.
Exactly. So you have a massive anti-incumbent mood at 5% unemployment and instead of 10.
How much do you think this is also basically xenophobia in the case of Europe with immigration, in the case of U.S.? I'm not sure why, because of Obama's success that actually angered people who like to keep their white privilege. How much do you think of it is people, even including in the U.S., that minorities are increasingly becoming... dominant's not the right word, but like, for instance, in California, that's very heavily Democratic. They still, you know, it's like there's basically no majority left. There's no ethnic group that's a majority. And so it's sort of like last throes of people trying to keep what they thought was America from a while ago. But in the case of Europe, I know, like, I'm living in Romania, and I've also been in Poland and Latvia recently. And I've heard, you know, many people speak about basically this desire, you know, that they think that their countries are a specific ethnic group, a specific religion, and anything that's going against that is a threat to them. And that's separate from an economic threat.
Okay, yes, that may be the case in a bunch of countries. I have to admit that I do not know all European countries equally well, obviously, and the reasons can be quite different.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For Germany, I would reject the often heard characterization of what happened as a rightward shift of the entire political landscape, because let's not forget that on the refugee crisis, I mean, whatever you think of Angela Merkel.
It's a very small minority in Germany compared to some other countries.
For the AfD, it's only 13%, but I think more importantly, we need to accept, right, whether we like it or not, that on this question, Angela Merkel has moved a traditional center-right party heavily to the left. She has pursued a policy that was, I mean, okay, can debate whether how neatly this fits into a left-right paradigm. But for the most part, most people would say that, yes, accepting refugees into the country is the more lefty position here. Now, not all lefties will agree with that, and some people... But let's just accept this premise for now. On this question, Angela Merkel has pursued a policy that was part to the left, many nominally left governments in Europe, and was probably to the left of what previous German governments, including SPD governments, would have done in the same situation. So we see that your traditional party, center-right, has shifted leftwards, and that opened up a...
How much of that is Angela Merkel's personality? Is that just her, or is that a larger phenomenon?
It is. It's hard to say. I do think that Angela Merkel had an easier time doing this than others, because that others would have had. I don't think that she personally is easily captured by terms like left or right. Nor do I think that pragmatic as a term offers you a lot of analytical insight here. I think that...
Would she be a good forecaster?
No, seriously, I do. I mean,
yeah, it was a serious question. I would think that too.
I will go on record saying I have never voted for Angela Merkel, but I have, at this point, a great deal of respect for her. I have to say this. And I think that she is a very smart person and someone who is absolutely willing to change opinion and course in light of new evidence. I do think that she would make a good forecaster. Yeah. So has she done something that, you know, at the same time, I would also say that remains an open question whether she's done something that may produce unforeseen long-term consequences. But there could be a long-term impact on the political landscape that we cannot yet foresee. So maybe we will look back at this in 50 years and think that it was a terrible miscalculation. It's quite a possibility, yeah. Regardless of the actual, you know, limited direct consequences of the policy. Okay, so how do I wrap this up? I do think that on many counts, the traditional major parties simply have become very indistinguishable in many countries on a policy level. And that this has, for some reason, hit the center-left parties more. This is a major factor for the emergence of a new political movement. Not sure how insightful that really is at this point. And I don't really have a good forecast for the future of political future of Europe at this point.
Yeah.
Who does? It remains interesting. I could answer you some more specific questions. I still think I'm not entirely pessimistic. I think there is some chance that Europe and the European Union comes out of this strengthened at the end of the day. Because this is, again, it sounds like a tired cliche to say, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I don't agree with it this way, but I would also say that a system that has weathered certain crises, we can confidentially judge to be stronger than one that has not weathered these crises yet. Maybe the European Union, I mean, honestly, this is something that the super forecasters on the whole were relatively good about, right? By the way, this is another thing that I noticed writing the book. We have this tendency to always talk about the things that we got wrong. And at some point, my editor tells me, like, come on, but you have to give us some questions on which you were right, right? And I was almost hesitant to do so. We should keep in mind that we were, by and large, pretty good, I think, on predicting the fallout of the European economic and fiscal crisis. That we, most of us, correctly predicted that the Eurozone would not explode, that the euro did not collapse, right? And
that's true.
And you know, it's if you look at what people, the scenarios people discussed as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, things could have been a lot worse. And I don't think that it's all doom and gloom, really. But yeah, it remains interesting.
On that relatively happy note, we should probably wrap up. Scott, do you have any more questions?
No, it's very informative.
Yeah, that was really great. Thank you, Bruno. We would love to have you on again sometime.
I would be very happy.
That's excellent.
Thank you very much, Bruno. We will be back next week.